Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking about mental health services here in New Mexico. I'm very happy now to welcome to the show Greg McGregor and Siegfried Hollis. They are photographers and photographic educators, and they are co-authors of the book In Search of Dominguez and Escalante, Photographing the 1776 Spanish Expedition Through the Southwest. And they will be speaking this Sunday, April 17th, from 2 to 4 at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So let's talk for a moment first about who these people were. Who were Dominguez and Escalante?
They were two friars in New Mexico. Dominguez was the elder of the two. He was essentially the originator of the idea to take this trek from Santa Fe all the way to California, right? And that was the purpose of this, was to find an overland route to reach the most western presidio that the Spanish Empire had.
Right. And through literally uncharted territory.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the tempting connection was that Santa Fe and Monterey are on the same latitude geographically. And so the initial thought was, let's just go straight west to get there. But basically rumors of hostile Indians along that route were abound. And so they decided to go north from Santa Fe to try to get to Monterey.
So that's what they were doing, and I find it fascinating that this is 1776, and there is a complete disconnect between what's... I mean, they started out on almost literally the 4th of July.
Exactly, yes.
And the total disconnect between what was happening on the East Coast at the same time.
It's really amazing how little is known about this particular trek on the East Coast. It's such an important expedition. It begins to chart fundamental issues like, where can you build a presidio? Where can you build communities? Where the Indians are located? What the river sources are like? All of this is critical to the expansion of the Spanish Empire. Right?
Now, what were the documents that you were working with that helped you, too, to retrace the route that these folks went on?
Well, there's been two major books written on this project. One from 1951 by a scholar from the University of California, Berkeley, and the other one from a scholar at Brigham Young University. They were celebrating the 1776 bicentennial of this event, and they remapped the entire route and made any corrections in it, previous inaccuracies. And we used the map from that research project as our guide, and we used the footnotes in the bottom of their books, the annotations, to locate sites. There's no guidebook to this project, really. And we followed it day and night, season by season, and it took us several years to complete this project.
So you were doing this for longer than they were doing it during the actual expedition.
Yes.
Oddly enough, since you can travel on roads and stay in motels and things like that.
Yeah, we would work in about 200-mile sections at a time. We would obviously we start in Santa Fe and go north to Chama, maybe, or Durango, turn around, come back home, and see what we got photographically or what we missed. Next time out, we'd go start in Durango, go 200 miles north from there, come back, see what was successful or not. And that's how we sort of worked on this project. I think once we just went the whole thing, didn't we, Siegfried?
Yeah, we did. And it's actually a rather extensive route, 1,800 miles. So we figured that we've probably done it anywhere from 3 to 4 times.
Yeah.
What was the actual route? They did not make it to California. They didn't even get close.
No, they didn't. And it's for a lot of reasons. They ran out of food. An incredible winter set in. It's equivalent to... If we read the journals of the Valley Forge, for example, and the severity of the winter there, where the Delaware River was frozen, and similar winter effect here, and it was really like a mini what would you call it?
Mini Ice Age.
Yeah.
They were skating on the Thames River in London during that time period. Yeah. They essentially went in a gigantic crooked circle around the Four Corners States areas. It's a wiggly path. They came back through Albuquerque after leaving through Chama. 1,800 miles in 5 months. And as Siegfried and I remarked once, we did the whole trip in 5 days.
Right.
Just to see how long it would take in a car today. And highway maps follow most of the route because they were following river valleys, which subsequently would produce cities and farms and ranching. And population would go into these areas that they followed because they were following water.
Right, and they needed water in order to stay alive to make the trip in the first place.
Yes.
Now, their goal was to get to California. They were friars, so there was also this theme of basically converting the Indians along the way.
True. That was probably their prime mission, because they were, after all, Catholic priests. But you must also remember there were 10 people on this journey. They had some guides that could take them a short distance that knew that territory. But for the most part, they had no other guides. Right? They happened to find guides along the way. But they had an extraordinary man on their expedition by the name of Mira E. Pacheco, who was a cartographer, but also an extraordinary santero artist, a military strategist. He was the former head of the Santa Fe Militia, a really brilliant man. So the map that he drew at the end of the journey was probably the most, wouldn't you say, probably the most authentic map and correct map of that area.
Right? Yeah, in some ways his name should appear on this expedition's title. It's really kind of a three-person thing. He was a very important member of that expedition. But back to your comment about the Indians they met. They met several, about four groups, large groups of Indians on this circle. And it seems they were treated and responded to very differently, depending on the tribe they ran into. The first one being up near north of Durango, up in the Grand Mesa, sort of near Grand Junction, essentially. They ran into a traveling tribe of 80 Ute Indians who were armed, presumably with Stone Age tools. We don't think they had muskets at that point in time up there. But basically their response was, go back home. Don't travel through our lands. The Comanches will kill you if you go any further. And they were there for two reasons. One, to try to convert these people to Christians, but secondly, they needed a guide. And these Utes didn't even want them to take the guide that they eventually agreed to go with them. And they tried to tell him, don't go with these people, don't take them any further. So they were very, but on the other hand, they had very little contact with Spanish before. They'd heard about the Spanish down in Santa Fe, and they'd heard of their power, possibly through slaving stories. But basically, these people kind of bullied their way through this Ute Indian nation, and the last request the Utes had was, well, give us a letter or send a letter back to Santa Fe so that if you're killed, they won't think we did it.
Right.
I don't know how they expected that to happen because no one was going back to Santa Fe from this trip. Mm-hmm. But that was their response. Siegfried, how about Provo Lake, the next big group?
Yeah. Provo, once the friars got a look at Provo Lake, which it's not a salt lake, it's a freshwater lake. Enormous pasture areas, land that could be cultivated, much the richer, fertile area than Santa Fe could ever be, right? They made some distinct annotations as to what one would find there and why we should really cultivate this area. But nothing happened after that. And when they returned, that area was literally forgotten about for a number of reasons, which I won't go into now, but It's the highest or the largest concentration of Native Americans was in that area.
Yeah, right? It was an incredible find. No one had ever stumbled into that lake and recorded it before. And today, just go to Provo sometime and see what's happened there. It's a huge, fertile valley. Brigham Young would take his people just up to Salt Lake City 70 years later. He knew about it. The the natives are also were so impressed with the Spaniards' magic tricks, let's say, that they had magnifying glass they could start a fire with, they had guns they could kill an animal with by shooting, that they almost begged the Spaniards to come back next year and bring along with them settlers. And the hidden agenda here would be, if you do this, you'll protect us from our enemies.
Right.
Because tribes in those parts of the country were just, they were at war with each other. They'd raid each other. And so they, the fish eaters, as they were called, saw the expedition leave, but with that great promise, we will be back. And that was actually part of the Spanish journals that shows up over and over again in the journals. When they would stumble into a fertile valley, they recorded the rivers that fed it, the pasturage possibilities, the game that was there, the fish that were there, the timber that was there, with the notion, someday we'll come back and settle these areas out of the Santa Fe settlements. Spanish will come north.
How successful were these people in doing the conversions, the converting the Indians as they were trying to do?
In rare cases, they actually did conversions. They did baptisms. But for the most part, they would say, we'll come back and we'll send priests to live among you, and they will take care of the conversion, right?
Now, this is a project that you two took on. The book is called In Search of Dominguez and Escalante, Photographing the 1776 Spanish Expedition Through the Southwest. We're talking to Greg McGregor and Siegfried Hollos. When you think about the expedition, and you have a lot of text from the original documents translated into English, and then you look at the photographs that the two of you did, and there's junkyards and funny, weird abandoned houses and coal mines and dams and all these human structures, it's almost impossible, at least from the photographs, to put yourself into the mindset of what these people were seeing.
Yeah, well, that's... we're realists. We recognize the fact that land that was traversed by the friars had ultimately profoundly changed, right? And there was no way to create a romantic vision of what they had experienced. Or on many occasions, we did find the land as it possibly was when they were there. But we also had to recognize that there were changes that had great impact on environmental issues, had great impact in terms of resources, mining, and so forth. So it's really a realist perspective on their routes, rather, right? Mm-hmm.
How do the two go together? There's the route the way it is now, uh-huh, with all this crazy stuff on it. There's the route that they took that didn't have any of that, that was really clear.
Virgin.
Well, I mean, to whatever extent the native people there had cultivated that land, but it certainly, if I may guess, they didn't kind of uglify it the way that that we have done.
Yeah,
so how did those two go together?
We wanted to create a book that engaged the reader. And if a reader is struck with a 200-year-old text written in quaint Spanish, and then looking at a photograph that's made at that same spot that the text was written, but 200 years later, and it's full of modern stuff, cars, telephone poles, highways, whatever, a thinking process necessarily starts. The reader has to connect those two dots and do some thinking about what's happened in between. And we could have probably photographed pristine wilderness if we wanted to, but that takes away one of the layers if you do it that way. Our job as writers was to connect those two a little bit. We would write text that says, well, why am I looking at this power line in the middle of the Escalante Desert? A voice needed to say that, and so Siegfried and I would write that voice. Other than that, we let the friars tell their own story. They were better writers than we were about that event.
When you are a friar in 1776 setting out on Santa Fe, what do you take with you, and who do you take with you? What did that expedition look like?
Well, specifics, there were 10 guys.
No females.
Two priests, two friars, Mira, none of which were paid anything. The mayor from Zuni was on there. He was a 65-year-old man, and we don't know why he was along.
Maybe Calde.
Personal adventure, maybe?
Yeah.
And then the rest were young guys in their 20s who were paid the equivalent of, we calculated it, was it two chickens a day they worked for?
That's right, or a string of chilies.
Oh, my goodness.
Or something, some kind of chocolate thing, too.
Yes, it? Yes.
Anyway, then the guesswork starts. They think about 30 horses, some mules, cattle possibly, because in those days Spanish often carried cattle to kill. But there was
a... Then it's a pretty slow-moving train there.
It was a slow-moving train. We can't find any accounts of them actually killing the cattle. And possibly they didn't take any, but they did kill six of their horses to eat, and one skunk, and two fish.
They ate a skunk.
They were just happy to get it. Yeah, it had occurred near the end of the trip, where they're out of food.
They would encounter various tribes, and they would try to barter with them. And they brought materials with them, like axes, ribbons, knives, and so forth.
And white glass beads.
That's right.
White glass beads were a treasure for some reason. Yeah.
And so they could trade those for
food, essentially. And also to try to encourage them to identify somebody to be a traveler with them, to direct them through these enormous, difficult passes. I mean, there is an exquisite description by Escalante that describes the Hurricane Cliffs, which were almost like an impregnable fortress. And they were literally lost in that territory. They didn't know how to get out of it. And eventually they sort of compelled an Indian to take him through that maze. And he was able to slip away and left them in a worse mess than they were before.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So you can imagine they really meant to... direct themselves on a westerly path, but they were without the kinds of guides that they would need for a more direct route. Plus, you must remember that the greatest impediment was the Colorado River, and that impediment was hard to overcome. The story of that in their journal is really a tearjerker when you think about it.
Yeah. So what was gained at the time, and what is the legacy for us now of this expedition?
Well, it's interesting. Muir's map certainly at the time was a very valuable piece of paper. It was describing land that was forbidden to travel in by Spaniards. Trappers, if they went up there, would have their goods confiscated and be thrown in jail when they got back to Santa Fe. It was a secret land. One of the reasons was the viceroy did not want any Spaniards going up there to antagonize the Indians, make a bad deal, a bad barter. Santa Fe was trying to defend itself already against raiding parties. In fact, they were so close to an example. This expedition was supposed to leave on July 4th, 1776, but there was a raid down in La Cienega that killed some settlers, and they sent soldiers down there from here on a punitive raid. And Father Escalante had to go down there to give service to the soldiers. Otherwise, they would have left on July 4th. But that's how close and how tough this place was to live in. They didn't want any trouble from the north. I kind of lost my train of thought. What was the question again?
Well, what the...
Oh, the legacy.
Yeah, the legacy and now.
Okay, the map. One legacy was a map. Oddly enough, the Spanish never got up there to settle. We've been kind of in our book. We read about that, why that happened. Several reasons. The Spanish government didn't have any money to resettle. They were supporting the American Revolution. They were in a war with Britain. there was no interest. These marvelous discoveries just went unused by the Spanish.
Also, you have to remember that. The furthest settlement of the Spanish Empire was really Abiquiú. That was it. From there on, there was no knowledge. And really, there was directives from the government saying you cannot pass beyond this area. But of course, you would have traders who would sneak through. They would have some knowledge of the terrain. They would come back with goods and items. And a big aspect of that was the slave trade, both among the Spanish and among the Indians. Right, but in terms of a legacy, I think the journal is one of the greatest legacies That journal is some of the most intimate reading about what life in the wild was like in the Southwest. If no one has ever written anything else, that would have given us a clear and wonderful picture of what was there.
Yeah, they basically try to describe the physical appearance of the natives they ran into, how they lived, what they lived in. Did they live in teepees? Did they live in huts? What did they eat? And, of course, how open are they to being baptized next year?
They weren't very open to the healing methods of the natives, as is written about in the book. Yeah. One of the folks got sick, and a ceremony was performed. It worked, but they just looked down on it as heathen superstition.
Yeah, Dominguez admonished it was Mira Pacheco who was sick, and he not only admonished him, but told them all that this was a heathen practice, and you do not. This is against your Christian beliefs.
I wasn't very grateful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, it never occurred to them to see this as an opportunity to really look at these practices and perhaps learn something about these native peoples.
Which then would have been more of a legacy for us if they had really recorded it.
Yeah.
I think they also, a funny incident, were up on the Grand Mesa. They were meeting their future Indian guide, and his name is White Bear. A long tirade comes out about how you should not name yourself after animals. You were made superior to animals. And if you name yourself after an animal, you are either equal to them or below them.
How did they even communicate with each other, given the differences in the languages? So there were people who somehow spoke both languages.
Yeah, there was one guide with them had been on an expedition at the Rivera Party 10 years earlier, and he spoke Ute. He was a man from this area here, and he accompanied them. He was a primary. But eventually, they run into Ute dialects they couldn't understand, much like we would have a difficult time understanding someone from Georgia if we were from New York. And so there's a lot of times they couldn't communicate, even though the language was Ute language. That was along the Cedar City area in southern Utah.
Now, you are giving this event this coming Sunday, the 17th of April, from 2 to 4 at the New Mexico History Museum. Will you be showing some of the photographs from the book?
Yes, we'll be doing a presentation of the images, and we'll have dialogue about each of the works.
Mm-hmm. Greg McGregor and Siegfried Hollis are co-authors of the book In Search of Dominguez and Escalante, Photographing the 1776 Spanish Expedition Through the Southwest. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
So in this segment, we are going to be speaking about mental health and what's going on right now in the state of New Mexico after the legislature. I'm very happy to welcome Frank Fajardo. He's the director of the Office of Guardianship for the state of New Mexico. Alan Martinez is deputy secretary of the Department of Veterans Services. Patsy Romero is on the board of NAMI, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Welcome, all of you, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for the opportunity to be here.
So there are, every year, a lot of issues that come up in the legislature because mental health is a problem that has effects on families, on the healthcare system, and wider-ranging social effects on everybody in the state of New Mexico. Maybe one of you could start with just what are we looking at when we look at the relationship between mental health problems and the responsibilities of the government of New Mexico to help deal with the issues that we have.
I'll be happy to take a stab at it. Behavioral health issues that encompass both mental health and substance abuse issues for individuals residing in New Mexico have a tremendous financial impact on the health care of all systems, regardless of what state you are residing in. And in New Mexico, it is important for us and for the legislature to address those issues, to assure that we have a comprehensive delivery system in an effort to more effectively and more efficiently manage the minimal dollars that we have in New Mexico. That's been a big challenge for us. New Mexico rates very low in the country in terms of funding behavioral health services. And so it's incumbent upon us to have a very efficient and effective system to manage those dollars.
One of the things that came up, one of the issues that came up in this legislative session was House Memorial 17, which basically addresses alternatives to incarceration. And that's something, Patsy, that you have been involved with. Is that correct?
Yes, I have been.
What's it all about?
So House Joint Memorial 17 that was sponsored by Representative Rick Mieta requires the Interagency Behavioral Health Purchasing Collaborative through their council. Right now, behavioral health services are managed through the Behavioral Health Purchasing Collaborative. And they are asking them to convene stakeholders to develop more humane strategies to serve people with mental health disorders. There's always a stigma with people with behavioral health service issues, and so that's very important. They want to reduce the number of people with mental health disorders that require law enforcement intervention. Often
are, that must be a huge problem.
Yes, it is. It's a huge issue. And sometimes our individuals with mental health disorders often end up in the criminal justice system. And so it's very important for us to look at that. They'd also like the task force to reduce the number of people with mental health disorders in detention centers. Our detention centers are filled with individuals with mental illnesses, and it's extremely important that we address that issue in New Mexico.
How do you address those things?
Well, through various interactions and interventions. Education is the most important component. Educating people about individuals with mental disorders in communities, making sure that we, as a system of care, look at the treatment of these individuals and look at the treatment courts. How are they addressing these issues and not just incarcerating people but sending people to treatment versus the jails or detention centers?
What are treatment courts?
Right now we have mental health courts across the state. And individuals who have been arrested for mental issues will go to court, and the court will require a treatment strategy for that individual. And many times it's in outpatient treatment so that individuals don't have to go to jails or detention centers and can be served. The court monitors their treatment and works with the treatment providers in order to assure that people are being served and are in compliance with their treatment.
Now, there's a bill that passed that actually requires crisis intervention training at the police academy.
Correct. House Bill 93 that was sponsored by Representative Ed Sandoval and Senator David Ulibarri requires that there's an additional 8 hours of crisis intervention training, focusing mainly on the de-escalation of an event when law enforcement interacts with somebody with a mental illness. There's 32 hours of crisis intervention training that a basic law enforcement officer has to go through for his basic law enforcement training. We want to introduce 8 hours of additional training that will give them the tools to de-escalate that situation. Somebody with suffering from PTSD, somebody suffering from autism, all these different mental illnesses, the one thing that we can get is if we can de-escalate that situation, I think it would be very successful both for the treatment of that individual and it's a successful resolution for law enforcement also.
Lord knows there have been some pretty horrible situations where a mentally ill person has either been shot or killed or at the very least re-traumatized by the police in some situation.
Well, one of the things that we enjoy here in New Mexico is law enforcement is very careful about how they handle situations. What we want to do with House Bill 93 is not only give them that 8 hours of initial training, but give them refresher courses, 2 hours every 2 years, on how to de-escalate that situation. It's not only traumatic for the person that is suffering from mental illness, but These things are very traumatic for the law enforcement official also.
Right.
What we want to do is de-escalate that situation so that not only does the citizen receive treatment and gets that situation de-escalated, but we're also protecting the law enforcement officer that is basically that first responder to that situation. We don't want to have that law enforcement officer have to diagnose the problem that the person is suffering from, but we want to give them the tools that's going to de-escalate that situation.
What are some of those tools?
Part of the tools is how you're going to approach that person. There's different types of mental illness. For instance, somebody suffering from autism. A law enforcement officer can't go hands-on because that person suffering from autism is going to have a reaction to that.
Right.
Somebody with PTSD, if you are extremely aggressive with them, they're going to go back to that military training and how they react to that aggressive behavior.
If they're military.
So all these things will be incorporated into the training. We're currently working with the PTSD National Service Center in California. We're working with the NAMI people, with law enforcement officials involved in crisis intervention. We want to bring everybody to the table to develop this curriculum, because we want to take care of not only that citizen, but we want to take care of a law enforcement officer also.
Frank, you are the director of guardianship here in the state of New Mexico. What does that mean? What is guardianship?
Well, we have two different types of guardianship. One is directly related to what we're talking about here. We have what we call the mental health treatment guardians that are appointed by the courts when someone cannot give informed consent for their own treatment or medication. And when we're involved, it's when there's no one else available for the court to appoint. There's no family or friends or anyone else willing to do that. The other type of guardianship that my office is involved in is not related specifically to the mental health, but to just life in general. When someone cannot make decisions for themselves, or they cannot communicate their decisions about other types of medical treatment, or it might be where they're going to live, it might be anything else in life. And those situations might be related to a developmental disability, someone from childhood because of autism or because of some other developmental disability, they cannot make or communicate decisions, then they might need someone else to make decisions for them. Or it could be somebody that's elderly, that's has Alzheimer's or dementia, or somebody, you know, with traumatic brain injuries. And there's a whole variety. But what we're talking about here is the mental health treatment guardians that are appointed by the court. And we have a contract with the National Alliance for Mental Illness. They're the ones that actually help us train people to be mental health treatment guardians. And we fund those. We don't pay a whole lot, but, you know, we thank God we have people out there that are willing to do that.
It's, I think, very hard when somebody is mentally ill, when they're first diagnosed with mental illness, or when the first signs come up that they have mental illness, to do the right thing and to do it quickly so that brain cells aren't lost, people aren't getting hurt, and the kind of progressive problems that happen when you wait, when diseases go untreated.
Well, in our office doesn't get involved in the actual treatment. You know, where we get involved is providing someone who can make decisions for that person, you know, a decision that person would have made for themselves had they had the capacity to make those decisions. Usually what happens is that the doctor or psychiatrist determines that the person cannot give the informed consent for themselves, and then they go to the court then to appoint a treatment guardian to make those decisions for them.
So House Memorial 45 passed. What is that about that addresses this set of issues?
That memorial is asking basically that, you know, different things that would be looked at. But basically that the Interagency Behavioral Health Purchasing Collaborative, which is one of the state agencies, convene a task force to look at the New Mexico law and to look at New Mexico practices related to the civil commitment proceedings. And my office doesn't get involved in the civil commitment proceedings themselves,
but in the appointment of the treatment guardian is very much related to that. And the other part is that they would be looking at the part we're involved with, which is the appointment of the mental health treatment guardians.
I just wanted to add that there is a statewide concern about the timely provision of mental health care to state residents.
Right.
So that's a big issue for all of us in the system of care. And that's, again, in House Memorial 45, that's one of the concerns that will be addressed through that memorial.
Memorials don't have the force of law, but they basically appoint a task force to study an issue?
Correct.
So let's talk about that for a moment. What happens when somebody in the state of New Mexico, you've got somebody who can't afford to put their, say, son or daughter into an expensive care facility. They're basically dependent on the healthcare system as it is, the mental health care system as it is, and the person is diagnosed with something or they're showing signs that something is deeply wrong. What happens then?
Well, I think we're fortunate in the state of New Mexico that we have certified community mental health centers across the state. There are community mental health centers in just about every region of the state. Currently, I believe there are 17. We also have identified certified children's providers across the state that can provide, they serve as the safety net for individuals with mental illness who cannot afford behavioral health or mental health services. Now, again, the funding is limited, but providers do receive some of those funds in order to provide those needed services for individuals across the state of New Mexico. I think it's important that we comment that the provider community who serve as the safety net for behavioral health services in New Mexico have done a tremendous job over the past 6 years as we've transitioned from one approach to funding behavioral health services, example, using a managed care organization to manage our services versus a state agency. And the providers in the state of New Mexico have been faced with tremendous administrative costs to continue to administer these services. But they've done a very, very good job for us across the state in meeting those needs.
Why are the administrative costs so high?
Because you've been transitioning from one type of bureaucracy to another, if you would, for lack of a better description. So 6 years ago, the state of New Mexico decided to carve out behavioral health services and to have those services managed by one entity, which is one single managed care company. And so we've had two of those companies in the state of New Mexico over the past 6 years. So again, if you're trying to do business and you're changing companies, then right, of course you're going to have administrative burdens related to that.
Now, there's another issue that I thought we could talk about, and that is there was... Alan, there is another memorial that passed during the legislative session that regards veterans and post-traumatic stress.
House Joint Memorial 5, sponsored by Representative Diane Hamilton out of Silver City, is to look at the feasibility of creating a veterans PTSD treatment facility at the Fort Baird facility down near Silver City. One of the things that we are looking at is... women coming back from combat are facing very unique situations when it comes to PTSD. Women who are seeking treatment for obvious reasons aren't comfortable sitting down with a group of men discussing traumatic sexual trauma that happened to them in the military. What we want to focus on, quite possibly at Fort Baird, is creating a facility that's going to be a treatment facility for women suffering from different types of PTSD, traumatic sexual trauma, post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, that will be focused on the unique aspects of the issues facing women in the military, women coming back from combat.
What do they have right now?
Right now, Fort Baird is not being used for anything. It's part of the General Services facility down there. It used to be an old Army fort.
No, but I mean, what happens to women when they come back with those issues right at the moment?
Right now on the federal side, the VA Medical Center does have a specific clinic for women. Can they accommodate all the women? We have thousands of women coming back, and unfortunately the anecdotal evidence that we're seeing is that about one-third of the women in the military now are suffering some type of PTSD. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the fact that right now we have about 19,000 women that are veterans in the state of New Mexico, one-third of those are suffering from some type of traumatic issues.
And a lot of that is sexual trauma?
The vast majority, unfortunately, are traumatic sexual traumas coming back from the military.
Committed by their so-called brothers.
Right.
Right. Or colleagues, I guess you would say, fellow military.
Now, that problem is now coming to light. Has it gone on before? More than likely. But these are all issues that our department is trying to bridge the gap between veterans and the federal VA. The state has to do something. These people fought for our country. They're coming back to New Mexico. They're New Mexico citizens. They're part of our community. We need to do something to make sure that these women are taken care of.
Let's talk about the rest of the state. We live in a geographically large state with a relatively small population, and there are areas of New Mexico that are very rural where there perhaps aren't the mental health facilities that we would like. How is that being addressed? What's happening?
There are tremendous challenges in rural frontier New Mexico to meet the needs of both adults and children across the state. That's probably been one of the biggest challenges. I believe that the direction that the behavioral health system has taken to identify community mental health centers and core service agencies to reach out to these rural frontier communities has been a positive step. It, again, because we don't have the services that they may have in Albuquerque, for example, or in Las Cruces or Santa Fe, these communities often find themselves challenged in terms of transportation and having to come into the larger cities to get the care and services that they need. Did you want to add something else?
One of the things that the Department of Veteran Services, in cooperation with the VA Medical Center in Albuquerque, is doing to bridge this gap between the urban centers and the very rural centers is the use of telemedicine. Mm-hmm. We're setting up the VA Medical Center in Albuquerque has contracts throughout the state of New Mexico, and they're starting to use telemedicine, not only for eye doctors or skin doctors or general practitioners, but we're also starting to use telemedicine to deal with mental health issues in the smaller rural communities, because it's a lot easier for that veteran to go to his local community center or local clinic and be able to have his situation. He can sit down and talk to a doctor that's sitting in an office in Albuquerque. So this is not only cost savings for the veteran, it's cost savings for the veterans community, and that veteran is being able to he's being able to be treated through telemedicine.
Now that's available to veterans. What about to regular people?
Well, I was going to mention some of the frustrations that we have, you know, with that issue. People are transported from the rural areas into the cities, you know, into Albuquerque, Las Vegas, and Las Cruces. We get a treatment guardian appointed for them at that location where they're going to get their mental health treatment and medication. However, when they're released, they go back to the community they came from. But the treatment guardian stays, you know, where the treatment actually first took place and where the guardian was appointed. So that is one of the frustrations that we're hoping to be able to at least address through the House Memorial 45. The other, you know, frustration we have is that there's no consistency across the state in terms of, We mentioned the mental health courts, but those are in certain locations. They're not in every judicial district in the state. So there's no consistency across the state in getting mental health treatment guardians appointed or with the commitment proceedings themselves.
Another direction that the state is really having to take in terms of meeting the needs of individuals who live in these rural and frontier communities is a true integration of primary care with behavioral health. We've talked about it for many, many years, but with health care reform, with parity coming up in the laws, in behavioral health treatment laws, it's becoming more and more important for a true integration and partnership between the primary care clinics and the behavioral health providers so that we begin to treat individuals through a medical home model and treat them as a whole, regardless of what mechanism you use to treat them, whether it's telehealth or but that is becoming very, very important to us and a direction in which we have to take.
Well, and that's a problem in all of medicine. There are patients who are falling through the cracks because the primary care and the specialists and the hospitals and the insurance and all that stuff are all these disconnected systems, and real health problems occur because of that.
Yes, exactly.
Now, there was a bill that passed, Senate Bill 438, which basically was to provide and staff a couple of safe houses, a rural one and an urban one, for mentally ill people in crisis who are in underserved areas. That was vetoed by the governor.
I have a small information, and I believe it was the cost related to that bill that is the reason for the veto, but I don't have enough information on it, but I believe that was one of the reasons that it was not signed by the governor at this time.
We've got just a couple of minutes left. What would each of you like people to know, just people who may not have be themselves or have relatives who are in the mental health system in one way or another, to know about mental illness in the state of New Mexico?
I can start on that. One of the things that I wanted to be sure to mention here, there's things that people can do to avoid having a treatment guardian appointed by the court for them. And that, goes to the advanced healthcare directives. And in New Mexico, there's a specific advanced healthcare directive, and we can provide the forms out of our office for mental health treatment and medication that's different from your regular healthcare directives. We can also provide the forms for people if they want to look into the powers of attorney, so that they can designate someone else to make decisions for them should that case come up where they cannot give the informed consent for their own treatment.
One of the things that I want to make sure that people understand is that New Mexico is very unique in that everybody in New Mexico is either a veteran or somehow related to a veteran. And if your family member is a veteran, there are services out there. We have different benefits for different veterans. Not every veteran is going to qualify for every benefit, but there are benefits out there. So people need to contact our local offices. Call my office here in Santa Fe at 827-6300, and we will do everything we can to make sure that you get the benefits that you've earned.
And I would like to promote and encourage people to use the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill in New Mexico. We are a national advocacy group, and it is important that people understand that NAMI is not just for adults with mental illnesses, but also for children. And we are available to advocate and to help individuals access services, whatever they need, we're there for them. We maintain an office 4 days a week, Monday through Thursday. We have a toll-free number, and we will respond to any issues that are presented to us. Our number is 1-800-953-6745.
Patsy Romero is with NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Health. Alan Martinez is with the Department of Veterans Services. And Frank Fajardo, the Director of the Office of Guardianship for the State of New Mexico. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.